This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
If you are new, visiting or listening on the radio, my name is Bruce Morrison and we are continuing a sermon series on Romans in chapter 7. I think it's true that most of us, not all, but most of us like to think more positively about ourselves than is perhaps entirely justified. There is a name for this. The psychologists call it illusory superiority. You like that? It means that compared to others, we overestimate our positive qualities and we underestimate our negative qualities. Some of us, of course, do the reverse. But I think for many of us, there's a propensity to do this. It's also called the above average effect. Most children are above average intelligence. Most people are more popular than most other people. This applies especially to those who have Facebook. And 80% of drivers rate themselves in the top 50% in regard to skill and safety. This is true. Anecdotal evidence also suggests that 90% of us think that we are in the top 50% of human goodness. We underestimate our sinfulness and find it difficult to believe that God would be anything other than very pleased with us. For this reason, God has provided a way for our swollen egos to come to terms with our sinful natures and damaged halos. He provided the law. That's what Romans chapter 7 is about. As we come to the passage which was read to us, which is from verse 7 forwards, I want us to recall two things from verses 1 to 6. Firstly, I want us to recall the parable which was in verses 1 to 4. The parable goes like this: by law, a married woman is bound to her husband as long as he is alive, but if her husband dies, she is released from the law of marriage. So then, if she marries another man while her husband is still alive, she is called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she is released from that law and is not an adulteress, even though she marries another man. Now, the woman represents God's people. In other words, the parable is about us. It's about you and about me and what happens when we come to Christ. The husbands we identified 2 weeks ago as Adam, the first husband, and Jesus, the second husband. We were bound to the first husband, that is, to Adam, the old humanity. Now, identified with Jesus, that is, dying with Jesus on the cross, we are set free from the law and united with Jesus. Our passage today is not concerned with the new husband. It is not about dying with Christ or belonging to Christ so much as it is all about being bound to the first husband, that is to Adam, the old humanity. It's about living under God's law. What happens if we live under God's law? It's about Adam under the law of the garden. It's about Israel under the Ten Commandments. The purpose of this passage is to demonstrate our complete depravity and to destroy our illusory superiority. That's his purpose. The second thing that I want us to recall, and this is from last week's sermon, is Paul's summary of our situation in verses 5 and 6. And verse 5 is like a heading for today's sermon. It's actually a formula. Verse 5 reads along these lines: when you bring our flesh, that is our sinful nature, together with the law, the law arouses the sinful passions and this leads to death. The outcome here is a foregone conclusion. It is a certainty. And this is what chapter 7 is all about. Verse 6 actually is a summary of Romans chapter 8, but you're going to have to wait a couple more weeks for that. So, for the rest of our time today, we're going to look at verses 7 to 20. They're not difficult. If we understand these two things, which I've just mentioned, they are, first of all, an explanation of what it means to be bound by the law to the first husband, the old Adam. And secondly, they are an explanation of the formula in verse 5. That is, the flesh plus the law arouses sin and leads to death. Now, thinking about the structure of verses 7 to 20, they're made up of two questions and two answers. And again, the purpose, to expose our illusory superiority and show us the corruption of our sinful natures. So we come to the first question. That's in verse 7. Is the law sin? Paul must answer this question because of what he has said about the law previously. Verse 5, the law aroused the sinful passions. Verse 6, you have died to the law. If you go back to chapter 5 and verse 20, Paul said, the law was added so that the trespass might increase. Paul, are you saying that the law of God is evil, that it is sin? And Paul's answer is, certainly not. God forbid. That could not be. No, says Paul, the law isn't the cause of the problem. Sin is the cause. Sin used the law to do its dirty work. The law was the opportunity, and sin used it. Indeed, writes Paul, I would not have known what sin was except through the law, for I would not have known what it was to covet if the law had not said, do not covet. But sin, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment, produced in me every kind of covetous desire. How does this work? Answer, whatever I am not allowed, that is the very thing that my sinful flesh will want. The law says, do not covet. My heart says, the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. The married life, the single life. The other man's wife, the other woman's husband. The other man's wealth, the other woman's clothes. There is no limit to covetousness. You can have the red one, but not the blue one. Now, which one do you want? The blue one. If you listen carefully, you'll hear echoes of the garden again. And it sounds like Adam talking. Verse 9. For apart from the law, sin is dead. Once I was alive, apart from the law, but when the commandment came, sin sprang to life and I died. I found that the very commandment that was intended to bring life actually brought death. If God had never given Adam the commandment, we would all still be in the Garden of Eden. There could have been no sin and no penalty. Adam was alive to God. But once there was a command, do not eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, up sprang the covetous desires. Surely, if I eat that fruit, I will be like God. I want to be like God. Why shouldn't I be like God? Surely God is holding out on me. God doesn't really want the best for me. I don't want to be ruled anymore. I want to be the ruler. I want to be the Lord. I'm the king of the jungle. And life will be so much better as king of the jungle. And there exactly is the deceitfulness of sin. Life isn't better. When everyone is king, you are no longer living in the garden, you are living in the jungle. Everyone pursues their own desires instead of following God. Everyone says, I know how to find happiness, I can find true life. And they end up hurting themselves and others. And verse 11, sin, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment, mark this word, deceived me, and through the commandment, put me to death. It's written in very similar form in Genesis chapter 3. In these few words, the serpent deceived me and I ate. So, what was that first question? Is the law then sin? Is the law evil? Verse 12 sums it up for us. No, the law is holy and the commandment is holy and righteous and good. The problem isn't the law. The problem is us. However, this is exactly where we can be so easily misled. We recognize that the law is holy and righteous and good. We say to ourselves, you can't dispense with the law. It remains true and valid and righteous and good. What we don't recognize is that the law can never help us, not because the law is evil, but because we are evil. We recognize the goodness of the law, but we don't recognize the extent of our sin and our corruption in our flesh. The law is good, but its very goodness arouses the sinful desires of the flesh. And sin, seizing the opportunity afforded by the law, will always covet whatever the law forbids. And then the good law will condemn our hearts, our evil hearts, because that's the way it works. So now we come to the second question. That's in verse 13. Did that which is good then become death to me? Okay, the law is holy and righteous and good. So how could something that is intrinsically good lead to death, which is intrinsically bad? Answer, no. It was sin that put me to death through the good law of God. The responsibility for my death rests squarely with my flesh, my sinfulness, and not with the law. Sin used the law to kill me. The law was the gun, but my flesh pulled the trigger. So now I'm ready to ask my own question. Dear God, why then did you give us the law? What was the purpose? Was it just to kill us all? And verse 13 answers the implied question. In order that sin might be recognized as sin, it produced death in me through what was good, so that through the commandment, sin might become utterly sinful. Here is the purpose of the law. It is a mirror to my sin. It is a litmus test to my flesh. How? Well, my corrupted flesh sees the highest good, the very law of God Himself, and it transforms it into covetousness and death. The command of God will never help me because of my own perversity. The law shows me up for what I'm really like. My illusory superiority is very, very cracked indeed. But Paul's not finished yet. What am I really like? The answer is in verse 14. We know that the law is spiritual. In other words, it's from God. But I am unspiritual. In other words, I am not from God. Sold as a slave to sin. This verse is the death knell to any belief that humanity is intrinsically good, which is something that so many people like to believe. But this passage is telling us there is no fundamental goodness lying at the heart of humanity, hidden because of our evil circumstances and our terrible parents. We aren't spiritual beings, each one of us, with a spark of God inside. We are sold as slaves to the perversity of our sin. How do we know? Because face to face with the good law, we choose the evil. Because the righteous and holy law of God only serves to arouse the perverse passions of the flesh and put us to death. This is Paul's estimation of humanity. Indeed, this is how God sees the descendants of Adam. This explains the formula in verse 5. The flesh plus the law arouses the sinful passions and leads to death. Paul uses the word I in this passage as a way of talking about humanity in Adam. It's the natural I. It's the natural man or woman apart from the Spirit of God. Now, of course, this is some good news just to lighten the darkness for a moment. The good news is this is not a description of the Christian life. This is not a description of the believer's life. And we must not confuse this passage with Christian living. Because the point of Paul's message here is that we have been released from the law and we serve not in the old way of the written code, but in the new way of the Spirit. And that is what gives us hope that we can truly serve God out of faith. But again, I'm going to have to say to you, that has to wait until chapter 8. I keep saying that, don't I? In the meantime, we're still in Romans 7, learning about the nature of humanity that is revealed by the law. And here is the clincher, here is the real kicker, friends. The law causes us to condemn ourselves. Not only does the law condemn us, but the law causes us to condemn ourselves. The law exposes our sinfulness even to our own sinful minds. And let me explain how, and then I'll read it. You see, what happens when we encounter the law of God? In our minds, we agree that the law is good. We say to ourselves, the law is right. I should not covet. I should not lie. I should tell the truth. And I should not murder. But then what do? We covet. We lie. We murder in our hearts and by our words and by our anger. We agree that the law is holy and righteous and good. We want to do what the law says. And then what do? We do the opposite. And our very agreement with the law means we are self-condemned. We come up before the court of God and we say, yes, I recognize the standard by which I am judged and I agree. Verse 15, I do not understand what I do. For what I want to do, I do not do. But what I hate, I do. And if I do what I do not want to do, I agree that the law is good. As it is, it's no longer I myself who do it, but it is sin living in me. I know that nothing good lives in me, that is in my sinful nature, that is in my flesh. This whole passage is a description of the flesh, the sinful nature, the natural humanity, the man in Adam. For I have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out. For what I do is not the good that I want to do. No, the evil that I do not want to do, this I keep on doing. Can you identify with this? Now, if I do what I do not want to do, it's no longer I who do it, but it is sin living in me that does it. It's my flesh. And the law causes me to recognize that. Here is the ultimate perversity. People think that they have done well to recognize that the law is good. They are proud that they can discern that the law of God is righteous and holy. They even want to obey it. And that is exactly the point of their condemnation. Because they acknowledge the good, but they don't carry it out. Anyone who really grapples with the law is forced to recognize their sin. And that is exactly the problem we have with the law. It not only condemns us, it makes us condemn ourselves. So the law reveals our sin to us. Sin becomes utterly sinful, as in the words of verse 13. It reveals our hopeless perversity. Now, one of the problems with modern preaching is often that it doesn't sufficiently recognize our sinfulness. What is the point of Romans 7? It is just this. If you think that you can live a life pleasing to God by obeying the law, you just don't understand your own sinfulness. You just don't get it. Have a listen to Calvin with me for a minute, one of the great reformers of the 16th century. He wrote, "This perversity never ceases in us, but continually bears new fruits, the works of the flesh. Just as a burning furnace gives forth flame and sparks, or water ceaselessly bubbles up from a spring." That's the works of the flesh. Jeremiah chapter 17 and verse 9. "The heart is deceitful above all things. Who can understand it? It is beyond cure." We don't even understand our own hearts. Calvin again. "I am quite aware how much more pleasing is that principle which invites us to weigh our good traits rather than look upon our miserable want and dishonour, which ought to overwhelm us with shame. There is, indeed, nothing that man's nature seeks more eagerly than to be flattered. Accordingly, when his nature becomes aware that its gifts are highly esteemed, it tends to be unduly credulous about them. It is thus no wonder that the majority of men have erred so perniciously in this respect, for since blind self-love is innate in all mortals, they are most freely persuaded that nothing inheres in themselves that deserves to be considered hateful, and that man is abundantly sufficient of himself to lead a good and blessed life. We naturally think that we can live under the law and that the law will help us. It won't. We are much too far gone for that. This, friends, is the reason that Romans 7 was given to us. It crushes our human pride and tells us that of our own selves, in our wills and in our flesh, we are perverse. It strips us of all confidence in our own ability to obey the law or to please God. It deprives us of our boasting. It confronts us with our incapacity to do God's will. It brings us to our knees as we recognize the righteousness of the law in its prescription of death. And it causes us to cry out to God for his help because we are incapable of living under his law. And that is exactly where we need to be in order to benefit from the gift of righteousness in Christ Jesus and begin to live a life of service to God in the new way of the Spirit. And so I will say it again. Stay tuned for chapter 8.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with Life Words. Subscribe to Hope 1032's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.